those making a difference in our local Harney County communities, join Randy Parks here in the studio. Harney County Live starts now, here on 92.7 KZHC.
Good morning. It's 8:30. This is Harney County Live. I'm Randy Parks, and joining me today in the studio, a couple characters. We do have local rancher Mitch Baker and Tony Svekar, research scientist, retired, still working, that kind of stuff, but both members of the Wetlands Collaborative through the High Desert Partnership. And good morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Good morning, Randy.
Hope you're both doing well.
We are.
Well, we're going to talk wetlands, I guess, this morning, rangeland, cattle, that kind of stuff. But before we do that, if you can both just kind of give us a background, how you, where you grew up, that kind of stuff, how you ended up in Harney County, and who wants to go first? Mitch?
Okay.
Jump right on it.
Well, I've lived here all my life. The ranch I'm on, is I own that my grandparents had back when they first bought it back in 1918, and been here all my life, and just grew up working on the ranch and other places.
Okay. Tony?
Well, I grew up in a military family, and so we traveled around quite a bit, but Colorado was always home, and I have my education. I have degrees from Colorado State and Oregon State. And when I was working at Oregon State, I actually spent some time in Harney County in the early 80s and then left and went to other places and came back in 1990. And I became research leader of the Agricultural Research Service program here in Burns at the Eastern Oregon Ag Research Center. And my background is in plant ecology and plant physiology. And so we'll talk a little bit later, I think, about some things related to the physiology of these plants, the meadow plants.
Now, as I mentioned, you're both members of the Wetlands Collaborative, and what's going on with that right now? What are you looking at?
Well, part of what we're working on right now is we held a series of workshops with landowners. Esther Lev, who is with the Wetlands Conservancy, and Dustin Johnson with OSU Extension, and myself. And we asked people what the concerns were about the meadows, what they thought some of the problems were, where they saw the threats to maintaining the meadows, because the meadows are not just the basis for a lot of ranching operations, they're also important wildlife habitat, particularly for waterfowl and migratory birds. So part of the effort of the Wetlands Collaborative is to try and basically do what we can to make sure these meadows remain intact over the long haul. One of the threats that people identified was people simply not knowing how the meadows work, and many of the landowners are worried about regulations that would influence their ability to carry on long term because people simply didn't understand how flood meadows work. So what we're doing now is we're trying to put together some information that we can use for educating people about just how the meadows function, what their values are, and those sorts of things. And part of the reason this article came up about the wintertime is that often people will come out here during the spring to watch birds. That's where we have our waterfowl festival. We see a lot of traffic. We see the cars parked down 205 where you can't get by, and Hotchkiss Lane and so forth. So, you know, we know the birders are out during that time. But once things dry out, often I think they quit paying attention to the meadows. And so we want to describe to them that sort of annual cycle that the meadows go through. And
how do you define a wetland? I mean, is it land that's dry half the time and wet other times?
It's so these are seasonal wetlands in a way because they are wet a part of the time and then they dry out. But they're, the two different definitions that people typically use are either a hydrologic definition that has to do with the water, how the water flows through a site, or the species, the plant species that occur there.
Okay. And Mitch, a lot of wetlands on your property?
Yeah, there is, you know, and very diverse. There's ponds, and we got high, you know, high ground and lower meadow grounds, but they all function in basically the same way. And you know, wildlife likes their wetland portions, and there's lots of species that like the more drier portions of it, but our meadows, they all, moisture comes into them and then goes into the ground and travels through the ground to the back to the river and everything. And there's a lot of different variations and species and functions of the whole system.
Have you seen any distinct changes through the years?
Well, that's every year is different. So every, you know, due to timing of moisture and precipitation of any kind, snow or rain, and yeah, all your wetlands change with the amount of moisture that you have to work with. And so your wetlands do change up and down with the seasons and also with the moisture and temperatures and everything like that.
Okay. And Tony, what's kind of like the things that you're looking at right now in the wetlands? You mentioned, you know, the ecology of it and the wet and dry. So can you explain that a little more?
Well, some of the changes we have seen over, you know, and these things tend to happen. Well, actually, one of them happened fairly quickly. We see species changes, and we have had a couple introduced species that now, plant species, that now occupy a lot of meadow acres. And that would be creeping meadow foxtail and reed canary grass. And reed canary grass in particular is a concern for some folks because it produces a lot of forage, but it's pretty low quality from the standpoint of nutritional value for cattle. And there's some question as to whether it has any habitat value or not. So part of what we're trying to do is do what we call a state and transition model, which would describe the major kinds of vegetation that we see out there. And we're trying to sort of group them into categories that make it easy for people to distinguish. So we have the what I call the head high communities, the really tall stuff. And then we have the waist-high communities, and then we have the knee-high communities, and we're sort of breaking it out that way, and we have some descriptions. What we're doing is taking what plant scientists do. They'll break things into small categories, different kinds of plant communities, and we're trying to group those into communities that respond similarly or have similar habitat values and make it as simple as possible so that I could give anybody a sheet that described the vegetation, and they could figure out what kind of vegetation they're standing in.
Is that vegetation new to the area? Are there new plants coming in all the time?
The reed canary grass has been around for a while, but it seems like really in the last 20 or 30 years it has really expanded. And Mitch would have probably a better perspective than me on that. But we've really seen a huge expansion in certainly the last 20 years. And even meadow foxtail. I started looking back at some of the studies that have been done on the research center. And when I go back to a study that was done in the late 70s, they don't describe any meadow foxtail or any reed canary grass. It was all native grasses, rushes, and sedges. And so sometime, I mean, for vegetation to turn over like that, that's a pretty fast change, you know, from basically the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s to, you know, I know that by 2010, we had much of the research center property that had been studied previously was now dominated by meadow foxtail.
What causes that?
I think they're very competitive plants. I can't identify anything in the environment that would cause it to change. One of the things we know with a reed canary grass is it likes the deeper, the what I call it, the areas where water stands for longer. Like if you look down the roadsides, you'll see a lot of canary grass in those ditches. And those ditches, as you know, are lower than the meadows around them and often hold water longer. But we think the low areas basically really favor reed canary grass. And it may be that we're irrigating for a little longer, holding water for a little longer than people had previously. Mitch has some thoughts on that. And it's possible that it was too much of a good thing.
Mitch.
Yeah, back to the meadow foxtail and stuff like that. What I've found, seen through the years, that it comes on and heads out real quick, earlier before all your other grasses in your meadows mature up. And they mature way early and go to seed. So whenever you do start harvest, and a lot of that seeds are already going into the ground. Meadow fox or the reed canary grass around our place, we didn't have it years ago when I was growing up, but now in all the lower wetland parts where we don't pasture or get it harvested, it'll grow up and go to seed real quick, but it dominates all the lower waterways and everything that we didn't have back when I was growing up as a kid. But it once it gets going, it just really goes, and it'll grow to 8 or 10 feet tall and puts on thousands of seeds.
Is there any way to, you know, kind of cut it down? I mean, reduce the amount of it in the area?
The only way to do that is if you can pasture it early while it's green and palatable. But most of where it grows is in non-accessible area, ways of harvesting. So it by the time you can get in and pasture it or something, it's over the hill or way mature, and it's just non-palatable, and cattle don't really like it, won't like it. They just bed in it.
You're not going to get it. Okay, we need to take a break. I'm visiting with Mitch Baker and Tony Zvekar, and we'll be right back.
To promote the health and wellness of our patients, visitors, and employees, Harney County Health District adopted a tobacco-free policy that prohibits smoking, vaping, chewing, or any other tobacco products within Health District property boundaries, including Harney District Hospital, HDH Family Care, and all other Health District-owned buildings, grounds, parking lots, and vehicles. Patients and employees who use tobacco will be offered information, resources, and support. The Health District will not monitor off-property tobacco use or in personally owned vehicles. Thank you for your support and cooperation in keeping our property tobacco-free.
Tired of smelling that old shop heater? That cabin barn heater on its last legs? Stop by Ed Staub & Sons for a new Val 6 heater. Val 6 heaters have a state-of-the-art combustion chamber which enables nearly 100% fuel-to-energy conversion. This translates to clean, odorless, smokeless operation and, more importantly, fuel savings. Ed Staub & Sons has Val 6 heaters in stock, and right now get $100 off and a free tank of fuel with purchase. Stop by Ed Staub & Sons, 429 Crane Boulevard in Burns. Energy, community, service.
Steel, tools built for real people and dealers who deliver real service, like JD Outdoor and Power Equipment and John Day, your servicing dealer. Find great tips online, like how to winterize and store your pressure washer at steel.com. When you're ready to make your next steel purchase, find out how to double your warranty on select models. Get all those projects done in 2021 with Steel. Shop local, shop Steel, shop JD Outdoor and Power Equipment and John Day.
Keeping Harney County connected. Harney County Live with your host, Randy Parks, on 92.7 KZHC.
Welcome back to Harney County Live. I'm visiting with Tony Zvekar and Mitch Baker, part of the Wetlands Collaborative, and we are talking wetlands, and we're talking two particular species of plants that were kind of growing. During that break, you were trying to explain, Tony, how they kind of eliminated all the competition.
Yeah. When we would do plant surveys, we would throw a frame down. Usually it's a meter squared frame. That's typically how we measure vegetation, and we would look for all the species in that frame and kind of get how much, identify how much cover each of those species provided to the whole plot. And typically when you'd have a full stand of reed canary grass, there was nothing underneath it because no light got to the soil surface. And that's those stands we're talking about, that the head high ones that you have trouble walking through. You know, if fortunately they're not real big. If they were, you'd get lost in them. But anyway, there's so much above ground growth, so much leaf area and stem material, that there just often is almost nothing growing below the stand of reed canary grass.
So are there efforts being made right now to reduce the amount of that grass?
Yeah, that's the problem is there is no control technique that we know of. And what we're wanting to test is whether controlling water more precisely would help us with that. And there have been some efforts to put in infrastructure so we could begin controlling water and see if areas that had a lot of canary grass, if you basically were to take that water off earlier, would it shift the composition to some species that the landowners consider more desirable?
And so, no, go ahead.
Well, one thing I should say is that not everybody considers canary grass bad. Some people like the fact that it produces lots of tonnage. So, but there's a trade-off between the tonnage and then the quality of that tonnage. So if it's not terribly digestible for cattle and you make hay out of it, you probably have to supplement with something else to meet their nutritional requirements.
Okay. Well, you were kind of describing the water in the area. Has there been a lot of change in the amount of water that the basin gets over the years, and that's enabled that grass to, you know, kind of be rather prolific in this area now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there actually is a flow gauge. I think it's not too far from Mitch's place.
Yeah, about 10 miles up the river.
That has been there since 1909 or 1907 or something like that. And we're thinking of trying to do more of a deep dive into what that data is telling us. I looked at it for peak flows, and my God, this climate is so variable that it was just all over the place. I mean, there was a year I looked at, and it was during the drought of the 30s, when the peak flow was around Christmas time. That was the peak flow on the Sylvies.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, that's in the 30s, right? So you're thinking, I was wondering, so are we seeing, because we've seen a decline in the snow accumulation across the West. And this apparently, this is not the kind of work I do, but I read what other people do, right? So they've been watching this and believe that since the 50s, we've been seeing declining snowpacks and a shift. It's not that total precipitation has changed, but we've seen a shift where there's more rain and less snow. So we're more dependent on rain. We used to store water as snow, and we're storing less and less as snow and depending more on rain in the spring to meet our needs.
Mitch, how would that affect your operation? I mean, if you're getting more rain, you're going to be getting, I'm guessing, earlier rather than the big spring runoff.
Well, I look at it kind of like this. I live right on the river, and so I flood if we get any kind of good runoff, and it lasts, and that can pretty much be kind of detrimental to my meadows and how they perform in the grasses that they grow on a real heavy runoff year. I've found I can have less water as far as runoff, and if I get good rains, I'm going to be raising a lot better quality and nutritional hay than I would if I had my meadows all flooded for an extended period of time. And in the spring, when we got floodwaters coming down, and that water stays on too long, and it impacts the quality of our forages and everything. But that's kind of on the meadows, but on the upland grasses and stuff, rains and snows do, you know, it all depends on the timing of everything, of the weather, the timing of the temperatures and cold and everything. It's all in the timing of how everything grows.
And you've got that all down, right? I mean, you know from day to day, from year to year, what's going to happen.
Well, it's a cast of the dice.
No kidding.
Every year's different, and if you try and predict the weather, you're a fool.
Well, Tony, does it matter the amount of snowpack that the plants have to be under for the winter time?
You know, these plants are pretty well adapted to to this environment. And what they do is they do go dormant. So they, being plants, they take in their energy through photosynthesis. But to do that, you have to have green leaf material, right? So there's a brief period, and it's really not very long. It's, you know, maybe late April, May, and June when these plants do the vast majority of their growing. And so they store carbohydrates, sugars in the roots and crowns, which is the, you know, below ground part of the plant. The above ground gets harvested for hay or just goes, turns brown if it's not harvested, or gets grazed or, you know, whatever. And then those plants have to survive a very long period with no carbon, no uptake of additional energy. And so what they're going to try and do is basically protect their growing points, which they need for the spring, and store as much of that energy as they can. So to do that, they try and keep really low respiration rates. And there's some things they do to kind of protect themselves from the low temperatures. But they're basically storing that carbon in the crowns and using it as best they can to protect themselves and make it through to the next growing season. So they're kind of like us. They hunker down during the winter.
And live season to season.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're a lot more like plants than we knew. All right, we do need to take another break. I'm visiting with Mitch Baker and Tony's Baker. We'll be right back.
Hey, Harney County, from small engine repair to boots and clothing, we have it. Robert here from J.D. Renson Power Equipment in John Day. Shop us for steel, power equipment, Husqvarna, and more. Need small engine repair? At J.D. Renson Power Equipment, we work on 2- and 4-stroke engines, generators, irrigation systems, and have firefighting and safety equipment. Find Prison Blues clothing, men and women, and children's winter wear, plus boots of all kinds. Have questions? Call Robert at 575-1156 or shop us at 727 West Main Street, J.D. Renson Power Equipment in John Day.
Harney District Hospital and The Center Orthopedics in Bend team up to provide orthopedic care in Harney County. We specialize in the diagnosis and treatment of disorders of the bones, joints, ligaments, tendons, muscles, and nerves. Working with HDH's orthopedic nurse practitioner Brad Mangum and highly qualified and experienced physicians from The Center, we are able to perform orthopedic surgical services locally, saving you hours of travel. For more information or to schedule an appointment, call 541-573-2074 or go to harneydh.com/orthopedic.
Ed's Staub & Sons has the solutions to keep you warm, including Val 6 heaters. Val 6 heaters have a state-of-the-art combustion chamber, which translates to clean, odorless operation and savings on your fuel bill. Ed's Staub has Val 6 heaters in stock, both large and small units. And right now, get $100 off and a free tank full of fuel with purchase. Stop by Ed's Staub & Sons, 429 Crane Boulevard in Burns, for a demo and ask about rent availability. Make an investment to save time and money. Ed's Staub & Sons, energy, community, service.
Keeping Harney County connected. Harney County Live with your host, Randy Parks, on 92.7 KZHC.
Welcome back to Harney County Live. Tony Svekar, Mitch Baker in the studio with me this morning, and we are talking wetlands. And during that little break there, we were talking about the timing of precipitation. So if one of you two want to jump right in and how important that is.
You start?
Okay. Yeah.
I'll start. So particularly, well, for the wetlands, but also for the uplands, the sagebrush country and so forth, that doesn't have standing water and doesn't get input from, you know, a snow melt necessarily. boy, that period that it really is important is when you have the sort of the intersection of adequate moisture and good temperature. And usually for us, that's from the end of April through May and maybe to the middle of June, when you have good soil moisture and temperatures are such that the plants can grow. So that's when the most of the activity goes on. So really for us, if we're talking about rain in the uplands, that April-May period is absolutely critical. And that's to Mitch's point about the timing. So when we look at annual averages, that doesn't always tell us a whole lot.
Well, you were talking about how the plant will store the energy when they're dormant and then when it gets a little warmer and everything, but that can be detrimental if we get a warm snap early in the year.
Yeah, it is for a lot of things. Now, many of these native plants that we have even the introduced species in the meadows, they're pretty, there's different kinds of dormancies. They go into a hard dormancy, and it takes a lot to wake them up. So they don't just come out of it, you know, a couple of warm days. They know better. They've been burned before.
And all it takes is once.
Yeah.
So, but there's really nothing you can do, right? I mean, if the weather starts warming up and you see these plants coming up, then do you make any adjustments, Mitch? Or just hope?
No, we just hope. We try and adjust to whatever Mother Nature gives us, and you've got to be flexible and be able to adjust whatever you're doing throughout the season. If it gets too hot too soon, you've got to adjust for probably less forage or upland grasses to grow of any height, but you've just got to keep adjusting your operation.
Through the years, has there been, I'm not sure if you know the answer to this, but has there been an increase or a decrease in the amount of wetlands in the county? Or is that something that you've not really looked at? I mean, are we still getting the amount? Are you, on your land, Mitch, is it expanding?
Ours, on our place, is pretty much the same. The wetlands, their survival rate is also is on how much precipitation and snowpack we have, and so I haven't seen them really increase any. I've probably helped increase a little bit by doing some infrastructure that I've done, but as far as the county, I don't really know.
Yeah. That's what I meant, because probably there's a lot of area out there that's wetland. So how are you going to measure it?
And it comes and goes. I mean.
Yeah. So what are you trying to get to with the studies eventually?
Well, we'd like to help people make decisions, or just provide the information so we would know better how changes in management might influence productivity and habitat values and those sorts of things. And we quit doing we just don't do a lot of meadow research anymore. There was a period in the 50s, 60s, and 70s when there was a lot of actual scientific research being done across the West, and there just hasn't been that much in recent years. It seems like other things have risen to the top, and we just don't see as much research. So I spent some time digging into past research, and there were some pretty interesting things. There were a number of studies in the 50s in Wyoming where they showed that you can get much more production off of flood meadows if you put water on and take it off and then put it on again and take it off. And what you're doing is you're allowing for aeration of the soil between those wettings. But if you keep water on there full time, you actually lose productivity, which is pretty interesting. And somehow, you know, it took digging into the old stuff. So you know the saying, we never learn anything new. We just rediscover stuff that as humans we already knew at one time, right?
Exactly.
So we sort of rediscovered this, and we're thinking of trying to work with some landowners to test some of these ideas again and see.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So are you going to try to throw this back out there and see if that information was correct that you ran across?
That's what we'd like to do. It's not easy given the way flood meadows work. You know, if you're sprinkler irrigating, that's one thing. You can turn the pump off and turn it back on again. It's a little more complicated when you're doing flood irrigation and your water only comes in a few big pushes.
And you don't know when that big push is going to come.
Exactly.
So a lot of variables there.
But I think Mitch has done that on his own, just out of curiosity. I think you've done some control of irrigation.
Yeah, through the years, we've flood irrigated and our place all the time. And I know going back to when Dad was around and doing the irrigating, you know, he went out every morning and made his rounds and put check dams in here and there and made little ditches go where he wanted them to go. But he was always changing the water around. And a lot of that for people has got kind of lost, and it did on me to a point. And so I've kind of went back to try and do some of a lot of these old ways, and I've noticed a lot on my meadows, the better grasses that's coming in, and and everything like that. We used a lot of manure dams back in the time, and one thing as a species that we used to have in our meadows or in our wetlands was bullfrogs, and we don't have them anymore. And it kind of goes back to the old manure dam we was putting in them bullfrogs. They would actually hibernate through the winter in them manure dams. And so that's one species I've seen on the place that has disappeared. And I think them dams was detrimental to their survival. And, but, you know, I always keep trying to go back to some of the old ways because them guys had it figured out.
Yes, they did. Well, we are out of time here this morning. Thank you both for being here. Do appreciate
thanks, Randy.
It.
Yeah, yep. Thanks, Randy. Appreciate it.
All righty, and that will do it for this morning here on Harney County Live.
That's another edition of Harney County Live, every weekday morning with Randy Parks on 92.7 KZHC.